You're listening to the Food and Farming podcast from AHDB, farming news and stories from across the UK.
Hello, welcome to the Food and Farming podcast from AHDB. Much has been written and said about landowners and farmers adopting new approaches to land management and being incentivized by government to produce food in a sustainable way. Timing for such changes could be ideal as the BPS subsidy payments are changing and they are on the rundown between now and the end of 2027. As custodians of the countryside, farmers are well used to environmentally friendly land management strategies, with many aspects of farming influenced by the need to take care of the landscape, which is, of course, your place of work. In common with other aspects of life, there is a balance to be struck as the nation needs feeding and demand is ever growing as the population increases. But is there a conflict between two sides? Or are we in fact being drawn closer together? Is it not in everyone's interest to farm efficiently without costing the earth? I'm John Bates, and today I'm pleased to welcome to the podcast two guests who have a passion for looking after all that surrounds us and are very much at the heart of the thinking to drive change on farm in a sensible and practical way. Baroness Natalie Bennett was leader of the Green Party from 2012 to 2016 and was introduced as a peer into the House of Lords in October 2019. A quick Google search will reveal Natalie's interest in agriculture is more than just superficial, as she is rightly proud of her science degree, having studied agriculture at the University of Sydney. Also, her working life began as a journalist, working for titles including The Times, The Telegraph and The Guardian Weekly. Communication, therefore, should be a strong point. I think you'll be interested to hear how Natalie believes there is a lot to be gained from balancing policy with productivity and consumer demand. So let's go to Natalie first. I doubt there are many people in your position with a science degree, Natalie. Do you think it helps you?
Very much so. And I think it's a great problem with our politics that there are so few people in politics with a scientific background. I mean, one of my more fun things was in my maiden speech in the House of Lords, I got tardigrades in Hansard for the first time ever. And I did subsequently after that kind of accidentally mention trilobites. So I'm looking for now my third arthropod starting with T for a hat trick in terms of my record on Hansard. But, you know, seriously, so many of the issues we're facing now, public health issues, you know, and not just the pandemic, but obesity, the quality of our food supply, issues obviously around the climate emergency, the nature crisis, so many issues, science is at the heart. And you don't have to be a scientist to understand them, but having that background, being able to talk to the scientists is, of course, terribly useful. So a message to all the scientists and indeed the farmers out there, I always say that politics should be what you do, not have done to you. So we need more scientists and more farmers in politics.
Excellent. Okay, so you mentioned politics and very clearly AHDB is completely neutral with regards to politics. So I don't want to go there, but I'm certainly interested in your view on how policy needs to be more aligned with food and farming and your view about whether we're going in the right direction to get the policies that we need to assist progress in agriculture.
Well, the short answer, one word answer to that question is absolutely no. In the House of Lords, I've been here for 2 years and the Agriculture Bill Now Act was one of the first big bills that I really dealt with. And it was really astonishing how little food seemed to feature in that. It was something that as the House of Lords amended the bill, we did manage to squeeze a few more references in. But what we have foundationally, I think the government, insofar as it has a philosophy of land use at all, tends towards the sparing idea. When you talk about sparing, where you know, you keep some bits of the landscape pristine and wonderful and great for nature, and you trash the rest. Whereas I'm very much of the philosophy of sharing, which is that we should be looking after every inch of our landscape, particularly every inch of our soils, and soil science is one of my particular passions. But you know, that we know that we can produce food that way. It's different kinds of food. It's healthier food, it's food that can build up strong local communities. It's a different kind of model, and that's what we need to go towards. But what we're seeing essentially, and yeah, we see this from things like trade policy as well, the government seems to assume that, well, the market will just provide. You know, we already produce barely more than half of the food we consume in the UK, and we can't be sure that the market will always provide. Food security with the climate emergency, the nature crisis, so many other problems that are affecting food production around the world. We shouldn't be saying, oh, we'll just go out in the world market and buy it. And there's also a moral issue there. Why should we be taking other people's food when there are real issues around the world? That's also their water that produced that food. It's their soils that produce that food. We should be looking after ourselves as much as we can. And the Centre for Alternative Technology, CAT in Wales, they've done work showing that we could be essentially self-sufficient in food with very different food and farming systems.
I think the levy payers listening to this, I think they'll have a lot of sympathy with that sentiment. So thank you for that. But there's always going to be a tension, isn't there, between the need to feed the people and withdrawing fertilisers and the other things which help food production. Isn't that tension always going to exist?
Well, I would say that the industrial farming system that we've got now is profoundly biologically inefficient, as well as energy inefficient, and disastrous in terms of the damage that it does to nature. There's a lovely 1930s Italian saying, way back then they said fertilizer, artificial fertilizers, which were new then, good for the father and bad for the son. You're actually, putting those fertilizers on, you're destroying the natural systems, the fungi, the bacteria, the whole natural systems that can make the soil naturally fertile. Of course, we've got huge problems with the quality of runoff, the quality of our rivers and our oceans. So what we need to do is move towards agroecology is the buzzword. I would say that we also have to get away from pesticide use. We've been through so many cycles of, we have this new wonder pesticide. It's perfectly safe and wonderful, and it's going to solve all of our problems. Then the problem starts to emerge and the resistance starts to emerge. And eventually we discover we can't use that pesticide anymore. We have to get away from that system and get to a system whereby we work with nature, we use natural predators, we have a balance. And that means getting away from industrial agriculture. And that can mean producing vast amounts of healthy food. In my case study, I learned about it and heard about it firsthand at the Oxford Real Farming Conference a few years ago. It's written up in a book called Miraculous Abundance, and forgive my French accent, but the farm is called Le Bec Elouin in Normandy. And there on 1,000 square metres of land, using a mixture of reviving historic methods, using modern science, permaculture principles, they were producing an income of 1,000 square metres of land of €22,000, a vast amount of fruit and vegetables, some bits of land, 5-6 crops in a year. And that's the kind of farming that can produce huge amounts of healthy food. And if we think about that food doesn't feed very well into a supermarket system, we've also got to think very much about distribution. Having local distribution systems, direct sales from farmers through local cooperatives, through local box and bag schemes. This is a different kind of model of food system, and it's what we need to move towards. And it's one that works with nature and looks after nature.
So is there a balance that can be achieved, a sort of a formula, if you like, between producing nutritious food per hectare or per acre on a farm, in your view?
Well, I think I don't think there's one formula, because, of course, it's going to vary enormously with geography, with soils, with local conditions. And indeed, that's one of the problems with our current system, this idea of giant industrial monoculture, that we have huge expanses, say, of rapeseed fields. You're on the train and the yellow flowers in late spring stretch as far as the eye can see. And what you're looking essentially at is a biological desert. And what you're also looking at is something that says to the pests and the diseases, hey, come here and have a feast. You can have a really wonderful time here. And we're fighting against that all the time. So if there's not exactly a formula, but one of the things that we, principles that has to underlie this is biodiversity, rather than huge stretches of monoculture. And one of the case studies I've seen that's just a wonderful example is Wakelands, the agroforestry in Suffolk. There they're using races of wheat and other crops rather than single varieties. So you've got, 1 year one part of the race might do well, and another year another part of the race will do well. You've got strips of about 100 metres wide with trees and hedges in between them, and it's bursting with productivity. and it's bursting with wildlife. And you compare it to, you know, the sugar beet fields, the bashed up soil all around that farm, what a difference it is. And that's the kind of model of productivity. And it's also, you know, I think for farmers, you think about the experience of that, that can be a much more rewarding experience managing that kind of system. Challenging, certainly, and that's where, you know, I'm very interested in agricultural extension and making sure that we look at new ways of getting information to farmers, not based on chemical companies, not based on fertilizer companies, but really farmer-led research that produces new systems that work for farmers.
In a few moments, I'll talk to John Foote about carbon measurement and carbon footprinting, and he'll be able to tell us about the tools and advice that's available from AHDB to help farmers make decisions on farm. I'm interested, though, about carbon offsetting. In some sectors, that's available. It's not available in agriculture. Is that something that you think should be introduced?
I think we've got to be really careful here. There's a lot of very simplistic ideas planted around here. And we saw this when I was at the climate talks in Paris in 2015. The French were big on basically saying, well, we can keep doing whatever we like and we'll just pump heaps of carbon into the soil. But of course, if you put more organic matter into the soil, then what you also do is rev up those natural systems of fungi and bacteria, and you get those respire and you put carbon dioxide out as well. We need to get vastly more organic material in the soil. In some places and in some ways, that will result in carbon storage. But simplistic ideas that say, well, this is how we can get vast amounts of carbon storage. You know, one of the problems is we need carbon storage, or we need reductions in carbon emission that last for centuries. And of course, you know, if you've, let's say you've allowed a grassland to develop, you've got that wonderful mass of plant roots. You know, this is a lovely, diverse grassland. But, you know, if you plough it up the next year, then you've lost all that carbon storage. So I think this sort of magic formula, it's a very sort of mechanical idea of that doesn't really work with biological systems. So we have to really provide systems that encourage farmers to get more organic material in the soil. We've seen a huge collapse in that organic matter. But we have to acknowledge that this is not some simplistic, here's a plane from some company or another that's just taken off a flight. And here we've got the carbon from that is stored in the soil, and then everything's fine and dandy. You know, offsetting essentially is a con. We have to both stop emitting the carbon and look after our land, which will store carbon as a side effect, but not in predictable centuries long way that we can rely on.
Natalie Bennett, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome you to the podcast and hear your views. Thank you very much indeed for sparing the time.
Thank you very much for having me. Anyone who wants to get in contact with me, particularly I'm interested in the agricultural extension, Bennett, BENNETTN at parliament.uk.
John, thanks for sparing time to come on the podcast. We hear a lot about carbon footprinting, and I imagine that you're very much of the school that if farmers can measure it, they can manage it. So what tools are available from AHDB to help them?
Thank you, John, for inviting me today. There are a number of tools out there, and there are about four or five sort of leading ones at the moment. And what we can do is provide a web link through to page that gives some summary information about these particular tools. But there's the Farm Carbon Cutting Toolkit. There's the Cool Farm tool. There's Trinity Ag that are coming to the market along with others. And really, depending on what sector you're in, you may also be asked to use a tool that the milk processor or the supermarket wants you to use as well. You know, in those cases, you would be recommended to continue to use those.
John, is this complicated? Perhaps if I, sorry to interrupt you, is this a complicated thing to do?
It's not complicated, but it does require a reasonable amount of data that you need to have to hand, such as your fuel use on farm, the amount of feed that you give to the animals, if you've got livestock, the amount of fertilizer you use, the amount of manure that you might apply, and the sort of timings of that. You then put that into the tool, and you will get back a carbon footprint, and some of them will give back some idea of the amount of carbon sequestered in things like hedges and your soils. Not all of them do that at the moment, and really this is why you need to choose a tool that you're happy to use, or that your supply chain require you to use, and that you then use that tool consistently year in, year out. If you chop and change between the tools, it just adds to the confusion, and the differences you will see will be much greater because you're moving between the tools rather than what you do on farm. The next important step is to look at where those hotspots, and all the tools are pretty good at sort of giving you some ideas of where you can focus your improvements, and start to think about building a plan so you can optimize those issues. And generally it falls into the fuel, feed and fertilizer buckets. And it's, you know, can you use less fertilizer? And that may be something that a lot of our farmers and levy payers are looking at the moment because of the high cost of fertilizers. So you can use RB209 and it has a fertilizer cost tool in there that enables you to optimize that. You can look at the way that you can use manures on your farm if you've got those available and improve the usage and timing of those. You can look at the way you feed your livestock, you know, and how much of it comes from homegrown sort of forage. And again, looking at optimizing those rather than reducing the amount of bought in feed without affecting the output of the farm. All of these things should, you know, help control those variable costs, those controllable costs, and then help to improve the profitability on the farm. So, you know, good carbon management is not poor economic management. The two go hand in hand.
And in the real world, you're using this out on farm. I think the Farm Excellence Program is really where this comes to life.
It is. And what we've done is we've gone out and we've used the Agricult tool with our levy payers, gone out and we've, in this particular case, we've also supplied auditors who have come in and helped pull together that data. We recognise that farmers are, you know, incredibly busy and doing lots of tasks at this time of year. And, you know, those consultants, auditors help populate the tool. And then more importantly, they worked with the farmer to identify where those opportunities for optimization and improvement on farm. Generally, there's never a big bang sort of change. It's, you know, a bit like the cycling world. It's marginal gains where you chip away and keep continually improving on the performance of your farm and you know, looking at those opportunities to make yourself and save yourself more money.
So, okay, so I understand there's a sort of a gradual build-up, but I am bound to ask, you know, being a little sceptical, you know, can farming really be done in a sustainable way and tick all the boxes?
It's got to be. We, you know, that's not going to be an option in the future. So, yes, we can do that. And in fact, when we go out and we're, you know, protecting the reputation of the industry, we keep saying that carbon cannot be used as a proxy as sustainable performance for agriculture or the only measure of environmental success. And we need to look at, you know, how we manage emissions to air, how we manage our water use and water quality, how we manage biodiversity and look at net gain. And you go out and talk to farmers and they're all, you know, keen to do something on biodiversity. You know, they're quite proud generally of what they've achieved and got on the farm and they look after and what they can do in terms of carbon and stack those benefits together. And we need to be able to do that because if we can measure those benefits, we can compare ourselves to the international peers. And we're, you know, Brexit has opened up the exposure of our industry to international markets and competition. And we're going to have to be able to compete on the sustainability agenda. It may not be the key issue that all markets are concerned about, but increasingly with carbon border adjustment taxes and other sort of green levies coming in globally, we've got to be able to show that we're as good or better than our peers.
I read in other sectors that there are lots of incentives, there are lots of things that seem to be happening, carbon storage, the airline sector and energy sectors, there's carbon trading going on and carbon offsetting. Should some of those or all of those things also be available in the agricultural sector?
Absolutely. But, you know, in order to get to that stage, that utopia where we can, you know, access that money, we need to be able to understand what the baselines in terms of, you know, in particular biodiversity and carbon are on, you know, our farms. Because in order to be able to access that money, you've got to be able to demonstrate that you are locking away that carbon or enhancing biodiversity. you've got to be able to demonstrate something called additionality. So you've got to be able to show that you've done something on farm that's delivered those benefits that wouldn't have happened otherwise. So that really requires you to have a robust baseline. So that requires you to measure your carbon footprint, to understand what ecology and sort of habitat and species you've got on that farm. Because if you can't do that and demonstrate additionality, you can't access this money. But also, in order for, you know, farmers to be able to access that money, we do need some robust standards and we need some policy frameworks in place that enable linkages either to mandatory carbon schemes, such as the UK emission trading scheme, and to understand how those allowances that, you know, one allowance equals a ton of carbon, can move from the mandatory scheme into voluntary markets. But also to make sure that as a landowner or a tenant farmer, you are being treated fairly, you are being paid fairly for enhancing biodiversity and carbon. And at the moment, those schemes aren't there. We've only really got the Peatland Code and the Woodland Code that set those sort of benchmarks. And we hear all sorts of stories at the moment about, you know, very low prices relative to those mandatory carbon markets that many farmers are being offered to sort of offset carbon, for example. And my concern is that those farmers aren't being paid a fair price. It doesn't reflect the longevity of the project, which again is one of the criteria that has got to be there. And it doesn't really pay for managing the woodland, if that's what's being planted, or the peatlands in the longer term in some cases, unless they're part of the woodland or peatland sort of codes. So, you know, I think at this stage, farmers should be very careful about entering into these schemes, make sure that they've got some legal guarantees. And if they're in absolute any doubt, seek some legal or professional advice or walk away from it. But I would say at the moment, the price is too low, and that reflects the levels of uncertainty and lack of quality around some of the offsets that are being offered. And really, the landowner may be stuck with having to sort of manage something in the long term. And I suppose lastly on this particular topic as well, when you are leasing or maybe a tenant farmer on land, there are further concerns about who accrues the benefit for offsetting some of these things. And again, this is where the legal frameworks need to sort of maybe catch up with everybody's desire. So, you know, for example, if you own some land and you're being paid as part of the sustainable farming incentive to increase carbon and manage for biodiversity, and you lease that land or sublet that land out to another farmer who's growing potatoes, do you understand what the baseline is before you let that land and what the consequences are if it comes back in a worse state? Because you might lose your SFI payments, and if you've been paid for carbon sequestration and the carbon's been knocked out, you know, what have you then got to pay to put that carbon back into the system? So all of these sort of new mechanisms, whilst they hold, you know, huge potential for the future of farming, come with a lot of complexities and uncertainties that still need to be addressed.
John, clearly AHDB and you and your colleagues are in a good position to help levy payers. So, you know, by all means, just again, plug the tools and the services that are free for levy payers to use.
So we've got our Farm Excellence Platform Network. We've got our BPS payments tools, and you can go in and look at KPI Express and look at how the loss of BPS payments may affect you. And then you can start to think about, you know, whether or not the sustainable farming incentive is something that's worth looking at for your farm, or whether or not other diversification opportunities or maybe some of these offsets are worth looking at. But, you know, the first thing to do is start to measure your carbon footprint using any of the tools that are available, and we'll provide the link at the end of the podcast. Establish that baseline. You know, you may need 3 to 5 years worth of data to have a robust baseline that will be suitable for carbon sequestration or net gain schemes. Build that up, look at the opportunities, the marginal gains where you can chip away and improve the productivity and performance of your farm. And whilst there is no big bang, you know, those improvements will help move you in the right direction. And I suppose, lastly, if you're doing this good stuff, don't forget to communicate it to your customers. You know, if you sell direct or through to the milk processors, the meat processors, or the supermarket. Tell them that you're doing this. Tell them that you've started to develop a plan and measure your footprint. Quite often they're also able to help you as well. Look at our website and see what materials that you can get to support you.
John, great to talk to you. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Spring 2022 is your opportunity to vote, to have your say about the future direction of AHDB. For more information, you can email shapethefuture@ahdb.org.uk or visit the AHDB website, ahdb.org.uk.